welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, March 1st, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Kia Lucero sits down with Brandy Morin to talk about her coverage of two top stories from the past year. The first, Imperial Oil's massive Kearl Mine tailings leak in Treaty 8 territory, and the second, the brutal displacement of an Indigenous homeless camp in Edmonton, and her ensuing arrest. Brandy Morin is an award-winning Cree, Iroquois, French journalist from Treaty 6 territory in Alberta. For the last 10 years, Brandy has specialized in sharing Indigenous stories, some of which spark change and reconciliation in Canada's political, cultural, and social landscapes. Her debut memoir, Our Voice of Fire, A Memoir of a Warrior Rising, became a national bestseller within days of its August 2022 release. Here are Kia and Brandy in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, Brandy, and thank you for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Tansay, thank you so much for having me.
So today we're here to talk about the Imperial Kearl Mine tailing spills that occurred back in February of 2023, as well as the Edmonton homeless encampments. So let's start with the Imperial Kearl Mine tailing spill that occurred back in February of 2023, and that spilled into the Athabascan watershed. So I've known it's one of the largest toxic tailing spills recorded in Alberta's history. Can you tell me and our listeners about what was revealed on that day?
Well, I mean, the day that, you know, the Alberta Energy Regulator and Imperial Oil came clean about what had occurred, because they had known about, you know, this massive spill long before any of the affected communities knew. And even before this multi-million liter spill happened, this particular mine had been leaking steadily, you know, since June of the year before. Again, the company knew about it and did not let the public know, the community members know. So when it finally, you know, when the Alberta Energy Regulator released an order for it to be dealt with, cleaned up ASAP, of course, there was outrage, specifically from the communities that were mostly affected, which were the Indigenous communities downstream that felt that they were left in the dark and betrayed about, you know, this information that this poison had leaked into the river system. So it unleashed a lot of anger, and just really for them, it added to the deep mistrust and shaky relationship between industry and the communities up there that, you know, has been ongoing for many, many years. So it brought this to light in a big way. You know, they went to Ottawa and, you know, addressed bureaucrats there. I'm talking about the community leadership, but again, this is something that has been ongoing there for many years, and specifically Fort Chipewyan and other Indigenous communities in the area.
Yes, absolutely. I've noticed in your documentary that you have done extensive coverage on those impacts of the oil sands on, like, for instance, Athabasca, Chipewyan First Nations through your documentary, Killer Water. Can we first go through what were the impacts that you found through your on-the-ground reporting?
You know, something that I was really stunned by when I was there in person, because, you know, for years I had heard about people being sick, people being concerned about the pollution in the water, in the air from the oil sands industry. But when I was actually on the ground and talking with people in the community, I was stunned by how many people that were sick. how many peoples whose relatives or cousins or, you know, friends either had passed away of cancer, were fighting cancer, or dealing, you know, with a type of sickness. And that this is just such a small remote community of like about 1,200 people, and such a high amount of the population was sick. And even when I was visiting people around the town who I was meeting and such, and didn't know what I was there for, that I was there reporting on the issue, they would just bring it up and being like, yeah, well, you know, we have our beautiful territory here and we love it. But yet it's poison. And I was just so stunned. I was stunned by the amount of children that I was hearing about that, you know, that were sick. And so it's one thing to hear about it and another to take it in, you know, when you're actually on the ground. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear in the community that people have. You know, these are people that are still connected to their culture and their traditional ways, and they go out on the land a lot, and they have bush cabins along the river, you know, for, you know, hundreds of kilometers around the area, and they harvest meat and medicines. But, you know, they're in this place of questioning whether it's safe, you know, to consume their medicines and the meat that they're hunting. And it's just, it's, you know, it was really striking to, you know, to see how afraid and confused everybody is, but also how they really want to hang on to their traditional ways, because the land and the water to them, with who they are as either Dene or Cree or Métis, is one and the same, right? So those are some of the things that I've seen. And then I've seen physical, you know, impacts. I would see oil sheens all over the place and on the shore, or, you know, we went for several hours upriver from Fort Chipewyan, and, you know, the river just looks like a soup of contaminants. And I'm not an expert, but what I've seen there disturbed me in regards to the various foam and oil sheens and different liquids that were churning and floating in this river system. And the people that use the river system, how they would tell me that it was not normal, that they had used these river systems for many years, and how they were seeing it change and seeing these new substances pop up and being very concerned about it.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think that that's like a common theme that's brought up and sentiment that's brought up by your sources and the people you interviewed in Killer Water. I feel like last year when that was unveiled, the Imperial Crow Mine tailings spill, a lot of the public were shocked. But it seems like the Athabascan Chipewyan First Nation, they have known about this for years, and they have suspected it for years. And they have suspected that industry had been kind of pulling the wool over their eyes.
Absolutely. You know, one of the people that I interviewed in my documentary is Dr. John O'Connor. Now, he had worked in Fort Chipewyan as a physician for a couple of decades, and, you know, started back in the 80s, 90s. And then when he started treating people that were showing up with patterns of sickness and getting rare types of cancers, he started to be really concerned and started to look into what could be causing that. And he knew, and others in the community of Fort Chipewyan in general, which consists of Athabasca, Chipewyan First Nation, Mikisew Cree, and Métis, you know, they had known about spills and contaminants, not only in the river system, but in the air. And then, you know, also the plants and the food chains, right, that all are connected together, and had been trying to raise the alarm for years, but weren't taken seriously. And, you know, it's interesting because there was a big article, a big story that came out on January 25th of this year. And it just, to me, this shows how people are concerned for reason, and they're not, you know, they're not believed or taken seriously. But this study, there was a study that was done and published in the journal Science, and it found that air pollution from the oil sands in Canada were way, way higher than reported. So they were a staggeringly higher, up to 6,300 more percent, these rates of pollution that weren't documented or tracked before. So from my documentary, what I've learned was that specific studies on the water aren't being done. They just do surface level testing. They don't test for certain chemicals and pollutants. And the province and industry need to invest in that to do it properly. Because right now, you know, they don't know the long-term effects, you know, of these toxins in the river systems on human health. They don't study that. They're not investing in that. But then when I seen this study that came out, that just in the air, the pollution is 6,300% higher than reported, it tells me that if the proper investment and attention was put into studying the water and other pollution, what would we find? And would the concerns of the people who are living this day in and day out in their communities, you know, would they be proven to have been right by what they're experiencing?
Absolutely. I think there's sort of a reluctance. I remember specifically in Killer Water, you asked Dr. O'Connor, do you think it's to protect the interests of industries? And I remember last year when we were seeing like reports from the AER, from Imperial Oil, and even down the line, Suncor, they again stated there's nothing. They didn't find anything. But Dr. O'Connor found his studies way back in 2006. These are high rates of cancer. For him, he answered your question and he said industry is untouchable. It owns the province and controls everything. I'm wondering what your thoughts on that are.
I mean, this is what I have heard across the board, like I said, from leadership, from Indigenous leadership who are affected, and from professionals and experts that are involved. You know, their concerns are pushed aside and the province seems to brush it off, right? And we know, right, that the oil sands industry is the economic engine of not only Alberta, but Canada. And if any of that profit were to ever be at risk due to finding out that, you know, human health is being severely impacted and maybe having to change or stop that work, I think that the players would do whatever it takes to, you know, to not have to reveal that, right? And so I don't know what it will take for, you know, the proper attention and investigating to be done to get to the bottom of it. I know that the community members themselves, specifically the Athabasca Chippewa Chief Alan Adam, they are launching a lawsuit against the province and industry, you know, to try and get this dealt with. And there are other, I guess, organizations. The feds are trying to have some sort of influence or say, you know, their environmental committees and ministers, but this industry just really has such a strong hold that often these voices of the little people, as in not just this instance, but in many examples of similar stories that we know about where, you know, industry is this giant that, you know, the people are thought of last. And so I don't know. I just it surprised me, but at the same time it didn't, to hear that it was not being taken seriously by the people that could do something about it.
And do you mean the provincial regulators?
Yeah, the province of Alberta, the Alberta Energy Regulator, as well as industry.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know it's been over a year since that's happened, and the federal government even announced the investigation into Imperial Kearl Mines and everything. Has anything come up from that? Like, has ACFN heard anything from the investigation?
No, not that I know of. I know that in the fall that the Alberta Energy Regulator absolved itself of any wrongdoing after, you know, an internal investigation. And I know that, again, the leadership of the Native communities were quite upset with that. As far as I know right now, they're still working on that lawsuit. I don't know, you know, what it's going to take for the proper testing to be done. I mean, I think it's more they have to create this public awareness as to what, you know, what's going on. But it just seems like it's going to be, you know, one of those things that kind of made the headlines for a couple of weeks. And now it's back to the status quo where these people are living, you know, within this aftermath of this toxic projects.
And I know you've done like a lot of coverage, especially earlier this year. Brandy, I'd like to move on to another topic, if that's all right with you, about your coverage over the last couple of months with the dismantling of the homeless encampments up in Edmonton. So throughout your coverage, again, what did you find there on the ground when you were talking to people around the homeless encampments?
Yeah, so I was only there for a couple of days. So I had heard about the dismantling of the encampments that started in December. And then early January, I went to an Indigenous encampment in Edmonton. And I knew that the crisis of homelessness disproportionately affects Indigenous people, that over 60% of people experiencing homelessness in Edmonton are Native. So I went there on assignment. I'm a freelancer, but I was on assignment for Ricochet Media. And the first day I just was checking out the camp. And that day there was lots of people there. There was the people that lived at the camp, as well as many advocates and other journalists. Now, they were expecting the police to come because their camp was on a list to have been deemed high risk to be taken down. So that day, the police came and it was so cold. It was like minus 40. They came that day and they walked through the camp and managed to negotiate with people in the camp and the camp leader, who's known as Big Man, Rory Cardinal. They agreed to just take down structures that didn't have anybody living in them. And it seemed to go pretty well. And so that happened and I left that day and I planned to go back the next day to get some extensive interviews to profile the people that were living in the camp and their experience. So when I came home that day, I noticed a couple of videos online circulating that there was a supporter that had been there who volunteers with the Bear Claw Patrol in Edmonton. He's a young Blackfoot Denny man, and he had been arrested just after I left and taken down quite violently by police. And so this video of this incident was circulating, and I posted the video, and I thought, wow, that was quite a different turn of events, you know, compared to when I was there. So I went back the next day in the morning and I was interviewing people there instead of Roy Cardinal's teepee. And the young Denny man, his name is Two Guns. He had come back that day and he had been injured. So he was limping and he came back to meet with the camp leader and they were talking about what had happened. And the camp leader, Roy Cardinal, Big Man, he was very upset by what had, you know, happened and how the police had, you know, treated Two Guns. So I was there doing these interviews and then all of a sudden somebody came into the tent and said, the police are here. And So I go outside and I see that the police are putting yellow crime scene tape around the premises. And within, you know, under 10 minutes, a line of police had lined up on a small mound overlooking the camp. And Roy Cardinal and the people that live there and advocates had formed a line on the other side. The police had asked to address him. And they had an exchange, and Roy was upset that they had treated this young man so violently. And the police, a spokesman said, okay, you know what we're here to do. You have a couple of choices. You could either leave peacefully or you'll be forcibly removed and your camp's going to be taken down regardless. And so he stood there and, you know, they said they're not leaving. And they put their eagle feathers up and police started to move in on them. And meanwhile, I'm there documenting it all and I'm videoing with my camera. And a few seconds after they went to plummet these people to arrest them, there's a bunch of chaos happening and screaming. And one of the police officers came towards me and blocked my camera. and said, you have to leave. And I said, well, no, I don't. I'm a journalist. And she said, no, you got to go. And she's physically pushing me back. And I said, well, no, I'm media. I have a right to be here. And she said, no, don't, you don't, pushing me. And she goes, get behind that yellow line. Now, they had created this exclusion zone behind this yellow tape, which is a media exclusion zone. And it's not my first time covering front lines of Indigenous conflicts. And so I was familiar with these, and I knew that they were unlawful, that they had been deemed unlawful in two different courts in two different provinces. And it was very far back. It was about 50 feet away. I wouldn't have been able to do my job. Meanwhile, all of this, you know, these arrests are breaking out while she's physically pushing me. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm not leaving. Next thing you know, I'm handcuffed and taken away and put in a police van and taken to headquarters and held for 5 hours in a cell. And then, you know, told I'm charged with criminal obstruction. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, I had to show up and get get fingerprinted and my mugshot taken. And now it's a waiting game. We have put my court date over a couple of times. My next court date is March 1st. And I keep praying that these charges will be dropped, that the prosecutors will come to their senses to, you know, to know that this is not in the public interest to pursue prosecuting a journalist, and that, you know, they have to look at the evidence against me, I guess, that the police have. But really, this is about threatening the rights of the free press that we enjoy here in this country. So that's basically where it's at and what happened.
I'm so sorry that happened. That must have been very scary at the time, and still scary now, of course, with the ongoing things. And I hope everything turns out okay.
Thank you so much. I'm a lot better now. I went through some really dark, a dark, you know, several weeks, but I'm a lot better now, and I have the support of top media organizations nationally and internationally, and human rights groups that are condemning these charges and pressuring, you know, the Crown to drop them. So I feel encouraged and inspired by that. So hi.
That's great. I'm glad to hear, and let's definitely take care of your mental health with that for sure. Now, I believe to date that the Edmonton Police Service has dismantled about 49 encampments, is what I saw in the last article I read it. What will happen to all those people?
Yeah, that's a question I think that everybody's trying to figure out. But the province set up a processing center for the people that are being displaced from these encampments, where apparently they're taken and offered resources. I really don't know how that system is working. However, I do know that we don't have enough affordable wraparound supportive housing services in Edmonton. And, you know, we really need to deal with the roots of this growing issue. It's at an all-time high, the homelessness crisis in Edmonton. And it's just being done so heavy-handedly by, you know, the police. Like, this processing center is being run by the police. And, you know, I just think that creates a lot of intimidation and disconnect between the people that may not have very good experiences with police out there. So I don't know if some of them are accessing shelters, if some of them are accessing housing, or if they're, you know, I've heard of some just wandering around the streets and really not having anything, you know, over their heads. They just carry a blanket around and are in, I mean, they're already in survival mode as it is, but, you know, it's caused a lot, even more stress on them. And I think that there's frontline workers out there that are trying to do their best to help the people that are being displaced as much as they can.
Brandy, I think that's all the time we have left. And I just wanted to say thank you again for joining me today on Rabble Radio and sharing your experiences and your coverage.
Well, hi. Thank you so much for having me and for highlighting these stories. I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Rabble Labor reporter Kia Lucero and Brandy Morin in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Kia and Brandy. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. In national news, the framework of a new national pharmacare plan began to take shape this week. Earlier this month, the federal Liberals and NDP came to an agreement that the government would introduce a national pharmacare plan by March 1st of this year. The NDP had been pushing the Liberals to introduce a plan despite opposition from the pharmaceutical industry. This plan is just the latest victory the NDP have been able to secure thanks to their agreement to support the Liberal government in exchange for some of their key legislative priorities being met. On Parliament Hill, an effort to introduce electoral reform was defeated in the House of Commons earlier this year, but hope remains that something can be done on the issue before the next election in 2025. During the 2015 election campaign, Justin Trudeau promised that that would be the last election held under the current first-past-the-post system. But shortly after the election happened, his government dropped that priority. First-past-the-post allows a party with just 40% of the vote to form an absolute majority government, as is the current prospect with Pierre Poilievre's Conservative Party. The Conservatives currently sit at about 40% in the polls, but if the election were held today, they would get a majority government giving them absolute control over all Canadians. Organizations like Fair Vote Canada argue that systems like proportional representation would be more representative of the kind of government that Canadians want. And finally, in art news, the City of Montreal is hoping to break ground on a new monument in honor of Black Canadian jazz legend Oscar Peterson. Peterson played a role in cementing Montreal's status as a jazz hub. The Montreal Jazz Festival has an award named in his honor, and the concert hall at Concordia University is named in his honor as well. Place Oscar Peterson, as it will be known, will be located between McGill University's main campus and Place Ville-Marie. It will include a fountain and a statue of Peterson. Place Oscar Peterson was originally announced in 2021, but was delayed due to construction on Montreal's subway system in the area. Construction on Place Oscar Peterson will begin in 2025. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have feedback for us, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with Rabble anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.